I feel like this is the little gift that's trickling down in people's individual existences, that they're starting to realize that life is precious while we're in it. And death and how we die is also precious and is our right. It's our right to care about how we die, or care about how someone we love dies, or care about how our neighbor dies.
Hey folks, welcome to the Brilliant Body Podcast, a forum to learn about and liberate the brilliance of your body and ultimately to expand the meaning and experience of intelligence. Join me, Ali Mazay, and other body masters to explore pioneering and varied perspectives on what it means and feels like to be embodied. So many people feel disconnected from their bodies due to emotional or physical pain, or even conditioning and lack of education. Others feel quite at home in their bodies, yet want to learn to have more pleasure, awareness, and access to the body's guidance. This podcast is for everybody. Each one of my trailblazing guests has studied their own bodies and others' bodies for decades and will share their expertise and unique mission, how to thrive as a body. So join us and reclaim your body's brilliance. Welcome to part two of my conversation with end-of-life doula and death educator Karen Ballone. If you haven't listened to part one, please start there. It lays the groundwork for the continued conversation in this episode. If you have listened already, welcome back. I'm so glad you're joining us for the second part of this conversation that is such a big part of every human's life, yet generally avoided and regarded as an uncomfortable, awkward, and often frightening subject. And we're here working on changing that. Let's jump right back in. I want to loop back around to several things you said. One of them is the simple question: how many people that you've been beside as they've been dying are actually afraid of hell, of going to hell? Even those who may have felt they'd rejected religion in their many decades as adults. Is that one of the kinds of things that creeps up at the very end because it gets so indoctrinated and deep in the psyche from often a really early age?
In my experience, I have found more so that people are dealing with those constructs earlier in their transitioning process. So by the time they're actively dying, all of those narratives have fallen away one way or another, whether consciously they've been talking about them and working with them. As doulas, my approach, if someone is still coherent when I first start accompanying them, it's one of the first things I'll try to start working with them on is, what significance do you feel is important for you to concentrate on now in these days that you have? What's the true meaning of your life? And you go through a litany of very simple questions. Where were you born? How many siblings did you have? What was your childhood like? Did you have trauma? And these are often, as you well know, questions that don't necessarily get asked. They're very simple questions for the most part. Maybe we've never even asked ourselves those questions. Even if you're in traditional therapy, you don't necessarily look at your life from this perspective. So that's the point, I feel, where people I have been with for the most part are addressing those constructs of belief, which oftentimes fall away to reveal something else. And a lot of times the beauty of starting that conversation is, let's say someone's Catholic and they have a fear of whatever it is they feel they've done wrong in their life. And if they do or don't want to address talking about it, it may come out anyway, whether they're conscious of letting it out. And that clears the mental capacity of talking about it, then it falls deeper into the knowingness of their life and their true story within their body. So things may come up, like if somebody loves the icon of the Mother Mary, that can be something that they're now holding that image and is helping them. You can put someone's mind in a direction if they're talking to you about it, and then the gift may be that they get something that gives them a sense of comfort. Because that's the whole thing, right? We all want comfort. We want a feeling of safety. We want a feeling of completion. These are the things. And of course, more than anything, across the board, did I love? Was I loved? Those are probably the most basic things that it all boils down to, and everything else falls away.
Is that an even more significant question for people usually than, was I loved by who and what I loved?
I think it's individual. I think it could be your dog from childhood that gave you unconditional love, and that's who comes for you as you're dying. You know, I mean, I think the comfort that we seek when we're transitioning, it's hard to know for any individual, but it lay within those real stories that are the sum total of our lives. And those things, where do they reside? Where does memory reside?
In the trillions of cells, I think.
Right, right. I agree with you. So, yeah. So there's a certain knowingness that the body has. When I trained in hospice, the spiritual care advisor, she was so wise, and she said a lot of very straight things to me right away. She said, there are no normal families. Because you're walking into these scenarios, you're trained as a doula, and it's a perfect world. And then you go into people's lives, and it's not a perfect world. And you have to develop skills to be able to handle and manage all of the people that are part of the dying person's life, one way or another, whether it's a circle of friends, whether it's nobody, or it's a family with all of its raging dysfunction, which we all have, and it all comes home to roost when someone's dying. You look for the signs as you walk the path, and it's not our job to intervene, really. It's not our job to say what anybody should do. We're not medical. We are there to hold the space spiritually, mentally, emotionally, physically. We're there to do that. So you're looking for the clues that you get and the connective tissue, and you start pulling on those things, and you just become aware of what you sense. I mean, that's why it's difficult to train people in the work. You can train doulas in the very specific things, and then understanding when active dying is happening and how to be in vigil at the very end and what that plan may be, creating a plan with the dying person and their loved ones for what they want their death to be like, what they want for disposition of the body.
It sounds like in a therapy session, for example, we're always looking at what is the contract with the client in any given session. And so when you were talking about you're looking for the thread, you're looking for the connective tissue, I was going to ask, that implies a certain agenda. And I was wondering, is that the agenda of providing as much comfort and peace and resolution? Or does it change from person to person based on what you surmise, what you excavate from these intimate encounters with them?
Yeah, it's so individual. Mm-hmm. Just like everybody's life is so individual.
Can you give some examples of any particular intention or desire that somebody had that surprised you of what they were wanting for their last days or hours?
It's interesting because the human aspect of our existence is so hard to quantify. And so when you're bearing witness and meeting someone where they're at, which is really where we come in, you're also, as a human being, observing the stories that go on between the players and that person's existence at this moment, which is very heightened. So, for instance, I've seen this actually a couple of times with older couples where the dying partner doesn't want the spouse necessarily there all the time because they've been the patriarch, let's say, or the matriarch, and the partner is maybe not being helpful at a given moment in time, maybe acting very childlike because they're not coping. And so you might judge that and think, oh, they don't want that person around as they're dying. Truth be told, it may be just that exact moment, because more than likely, they want that person at the very end. That's who they want next to them. It doesn't matter how that person's behaving by that point, because we're past behavior then. And what that is, I can't say because I haven't been there yet. That's one of the things that to work with the dying and to work with death, you have to engage and love the mystery, the not knowing, and to just being open to holding space for that. I think one of the things I've started to realize, and again, this is Buddhist culture, but all of these stages we are in as we're living, they are also liminal stages. We are always in transition, but we're not culturalized that way to understand that life is not fixed, but constantly moving. We're in a flow, so to speak. And that flow will transition at the end of our days in this life. What it transitions to, who's to say? But I love pondering it, and I love being at the space of that opening, which is no different than birth, because I've bore witness to both now in my lifetime. That space that opens up, that transitional liminal space, that bardo, that is the deep truth of existence. Yeah. And to witness it is to be in amazement and to be put back on your heels in a way that you do realize you can only know so much. And that's our place in this lifetime. We can only know so much. But if we can engage with the mystery, that gives us permission then to address our mortality. And I truly believe, and this is the reason why I like to teach now, I truly believe that once you make this choice to engage on any level, it could be very subliminal. It could be, I'm just going to open this slight door to think about what might be on the other side. Or I'm just going to think about, well, what would my deathbed wishes be? To ponder these questions, it starts to trickle back into your existence in a way that you just feel so much richer, so much fuller when you're experiencing being present in these moments that we're alive. Like you said earlier, I'm in that stage too, where I know that I'm in a different moment in this existence than I was for a very long stretch of time. I would say, you know, like 30s, 40s, 50s, they kind of felt the same in a way. And it felt like a great time in my life as well. As a woman, I felt empowered. I was no longer being ruled by all of my insecurities, my vanity. Like, it started to let go of me a little bit over those decades, more and more. And then to be in the 60s and to realize, like, oh yes, no matter how much more time I live, this is my third act.
Yeah.
And how do I want that to be? And I like that, being able to ask myself that question. And I think everybody does once that kind of freedom is opened up to them.
Yeah, once it's palpable, you can't take it for granted any longer. Definitely. I have so many more questions, Karen. I've noticed, and I've heard this many times, people will wait until their loved ones are out of the room to actually finally leave. What do you make of that? Have you also seen a lot of that?
I have, and I've talked about it with other people who work in death care and caregivers. My take on that is the pull to stay in the body is very strong, and that love, the bond of love, keeps us in the body to some extent. The force with which the body, the life force, leaves the body. This is a very specific thing as well. But I sense that we have much more knowledge, a different type of knowledge when we're dying, a different type of way that we are holding the energy of life force as it's transitioning. So that if people we love are exhibiting sadness and don't want to let go, I think it's hard for us to let go. It's an energetic bond. I have witnessed it myself, and I often can sense that death is close. It's so interesting because these are the sort of magical and mystical things that occur without us really understanding them. People will just naturally leave at a time. They know death is close, but they're like, I need a cup of coffee, or I need to go home and get a change of clothes. Or it's almost as if they've been given some cue of like, I need you to let me go. And I can't let go while you're holding my hand, you know?
I do know.
It's actually incredibly beautiful.
It is so poignant, so poignant. Yeah. Yeah. I learned a lot about my father being with him in his last hours, just to watch his life force, because his brain was already gone, just to experience the sheer and formidable life force of that man taught me so much about his personality and his tenacity, because they expected him to go many, many hours prior without the life support, and to watch him continue to hold on in that way and fight was so indicative of who he was as a person. But also this, whatever this magic is of being alive, this imperative of any living organism to stay alive was so vivid, was so obvious in a way that when we come in with our egos and our depressions and our traumas, we can forget how it is hardwired in these body beings to continue to exist no matter how much we're suffering. And of course, there's exceptions, and that's why suicide can happen. And I wanted to ask you about that too. I wanted to ask you about not necessarily voluntary suicide or suicide under duress, but chosen suicide out of a real decision that you just don't want to be alive anymore. Not necessarily out of duress, maybe because of a terminal illness diagnosis. What is your view? When is it something to assist, as we call it in some cultures? Do you believe it should be legal in all cultures? Do you believe that people, if you do, should necessarily have all their marbles before they're allowed to, or when they're allowed to be assisted? What's your view on suicide and specifically assisted suicide?
It's a really good question, and one that's certainly up now. I mean, in hospice, and I wouldn't think necessarily many people know this unless they themselves have experienced it with a loved one or someone that they've been close to. Voluntary stopping eating and drinking, VSAD is the acronym. This is something that is a way to end your life by your own choice.
What a terrible way to do it, though.
It's not painful to the body. And I think some of the stuff that we have to get over as the living, bearing witness to the dying, is to understand that there is no pain at a certain point physically. There can be. I mean, if there's disease in the body, of course, it's hard to say. Also, who knows what one being's experience of pain or pleasure is versus another. I mean, we can't make those judgments really, right? So you don't know. If a person who is actively dying and they don't want to linger and they don't want to experience any further measures, like for instance, if somebody has Parkinson's and they get to a certain point where they can no longer, their throat will no longer allow them to eat, then the next step to survive would be to insert a feeding tube. That's a very aggressive act. especially to a body that is already deteriorating. Some people will go with that. And often a person who is unconscious, that decision has to be made by the next of kin, unless they have a DNR, or in New York State, it's called a MULST. In California, it's a PULST. And that's the other thing. There's so much paperwork that has to do with these things that we might care about at the end of our lives that we don't know about. And that's a whole other conversation. But I think if a person is still conscious and they know that the next step is a feeding tube, it's their choice to decide how do they want the demise to be, because they know that they're on the road to dying. So now it's a question of how do you want to die? It's the quality of life versus living. So I think when people choose to voluntarily stop eating and drinking, yes, at first it may seem that that's cruel from the outside, because you're starving the body. And it's also something so personal and inherent and culturally part of who we are. Food is such a huge part of our existences. And also, all of us feel like if somebody's eating, it's all good. They're still alive. Even with our animals, we're like that, right? Like, you don't always know with your pets when's the right time. We don't want our pets to suffer. And most people have no issue with bringing their animal to the vet to end their life at a certain point. And a lot of it's, well, if they're not eating or able to drink anymore, then we're like, they're done. And I don't want them to suffer. I think it's the same exact situation.
But we don't euthanize humans when it is in that similar situation.
Well, we're in this moment, in this transitional moment in the United States and in other countries, where the medical aid in dying, MAID, the acronym MAID for medical aid in dying, is very much up. I mean, Vermont has passed the law, New York State, it's right now up. And I do believe in medical aid in dying, because if a being is suffering unnecessarily in the transition to dying, and they themselves have chosen this, who am I? Like any other story and life that I accompany a human or another being through, it's not my job, it's not my right to say anything about that. I am there to hold the space for whatever it is they choose. So if a person comes to me and wants assistance to be accompanied while they stop eating and drinking, then I'm present for them. If I'm sure you know a little bit about medical aid in dying, but a person who will accept medical aid in dying still needs to be determined by their physician as being of sound mind and body to be able to make this decision when they make the decision, and that they themselves have to mix the cocktail. Nobody else can do it for them, which is problematic. If you're dealing with somebody who has ALS, they can't mix the cocktail for themselves. So yeah. Whose right is it? I think it's a big question. There are certain diseases that people don't even want to think about, like ALS, which robs you of everything by the time you die. And I've watched some very brave people address this type of a demise in a way that I don't think anybody who would bear witness to another's life who's going through that type of a situation would feel the right to have any decision, any opinion, any judgment. It's so personal. It's so individual. And if we are willing to comfort other beings, what's so precious about a human life then, in terms of the right of that human to make their own decision about the inevitability? I would go back to the beginning of this conversation just for one second to say, as soon as I started this work and I started thinking about how do I help to raise a culture that I can help people to die within, because we're not there. I often come into people's lives way late, and then I can do what I can do. I can be what I can be for them. But if I could have been with them way earlier and with their loved ones, it could have been maybe an easier ride for everybody. Maybe not. And this is where the good death comes in. I mean, the good death is a little problematic because it's really a Christian Catholic concept.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. It is. It's in many cultures, but in Catholicism, it's there as you want to make confession and you want to be given your last rites and you want all of these sort of religious tenets that many people still do want. And I have absolute respect for that. But it's not that simple. It's not as simple as we might think it is when we think of those basic tenets for a good death. I believe a good death is really more that a human being gets to be heard and comforted in whatever way is going to foster safe passage. That's the way I like to think of it. And what that is, who knows? Sometimes a person can tell you and sometimes they can't. And so it's our job to be able to hold space for that in whatever way we can glean. That's why it's not necessarily just about a verbal understanding. You have to take your cues where you can get them. And a lot of that is about deep active listening, and you're not just listening with your ears. So when I talk about the container or the vessel, I like to use it as an understanding for people to realize that this body holds all of these things. And when we bear witness and hold space for someone who's in transition, whether it's a person who's giving birth or a person who's dying, our job is to be able to take in the stimuli, to take in the information at hand, to be able to serve the situation. And that's how we use this body then.
So eloquent, Karen, and absolutely one of the many reasons why I wanted to make this podcast, because death is spoken about even less than sex is spoken about. And I know from my own dying parents that it was a really important conversation to have with them. Obviously, the closer they were getting to it, even when they weren't on their deathbeds, for both practical reasons and also spiritual reasons. And the amount of taboo that is wrapped around that conversation is just, it's atrocious, really. So I so admire what you're doing. And if you were queen of the world, what would a system, or I don't know, how would it look for good deaths, by definition of how you so beautifully expressed it, be able to happen more, particularly, as you say, in the baby boomer generation? Would there be schools for death? Would there be more institutions or beautiful houses where people could go? I know you're in the process of creating a center. So how would it look to even begin to meet the needs of these millions of us who are headed in that direction sooner than later?
I feel it's happening organically, so that's very encouraging. And like I said earlier, I think a lot of it was post-COVID in terms of a subtle sort of shift in consciousness and awareness, especially with younger people, because their younger years are not distracted in a way from this. Whether that's a good or a bad thing, I have no judgment at this point, but I think that their eyes are wide open. I also feel, as I start to build my own home for the dying here in New York State, which is not hospice, and I'll explain that in a minute, but what I feel wrapping around us is small community that doesn't just have to do with being present for one another in death, although that's, let's call it the end game, but what happens and spills out from that coming together around death is, how do you want to live? And that is starting to feed these small communities of people that are thinking more about honoring the land, honoring the ancestors, honoring the other life forms that have been here and are here still, and feeling the interconnectedness of ourselves into the greater scheme of life, of which death is part. And there's a certain knowledge, innate knowledge, remembrance of the truth of life that I think is starting to influence people in these ways. And of course, the scales are so polarized right now because there's so much insanity and chaos going on simultaneously. I feel like this is the little gift that's trickling down in people's individual existences, that they're starting to realize that life is precious while we're in it. And death and how we die is also precious and is our right. It's our right to care about how we die, or care about how someone we love dies, or care about how our neighbor dies. So I think what I'm starting to see happening, what I'm part of here in the United States, is this organization called the Omega Home Network. And they mentor people like myself who are interested in having these non-medical homes for the dying. And that means we're not hospice. We're not bringing in means of keeping anybody alive necessarily. Hospice does not do that either. But during hospice, you might be on oxygen. You might be taking a certain amount of palliative medicine if you're having pain from cancer or other debilitating illnesses in the body. Pain and comfort are a huge part of how palliative care works, and a wonderful part of medicine that's not getting enough light shined on it, nor is it really getting traction in this country, unfortunately, because I don't think it's profit-driven. So, you know, there's that, okay? Profit-driven is a large part of the conversation about death as well.
I was going to ask you, when you describe this, how much is it contingent on some degree of affluence?
What I'm finding, because I'm still in the gestating stages, we haven't opened our home. In New York State, we can legally have 2 beds maximum. In other states, like in the Midwest, you can have 6 beds or 12 beds. But of course, then it becomes more like a facility as opposed to your own home. So what we are building is an education center. So we're doing an enormous amount of community outreach right now. We're doing a seasonal event called All the Little Deaths, which is just a place for people to come together to talk about loss and grief, whatever it is. It doesn't have to do with death and dying, could have to do with death and dying, but just a place where people can come to let go of some of that, not feel that it's awkward to share with people about those feelings. We're also doing a planned elderhood workshop, which, as you brought up with your own parents, the conversation is both practical and also not practical, more about what do I need? What do I want? What do I feel? And how is it going to be for you, our daughter, when we're gone? These are the conversations that we're trying to bridge the gap to get people to start talking about them. I think the biggest thing that we're up against in community, and this is politically too, is those people who can't or don't want to address the inherent existential fear, and those who do. It's a real sort of two camps, you know? But those who do, I'm finding that they're coming at us in numbers, because we need this. We need this to live better. We need this to really understand about what legacy is, what our lives really mean. You said it about your dad. Isn't it fascinating how we can live our whole lives? This is our parent, and we know them. We know them. But as they're on the wane, and those narratives of what we think and what they showed us start to fall away, what we get is the real truth, the real story of that human. And that's love. That's love.
And that is an opportunity that can be quite hard won, I have to say. If one holds on to the traumas and the resentments and the disappointments, it is very difficult to receive the opportunity that death presents to go to and meet that person, even a parent, in that essential place, that most intimate place of who we are as souls coming together, despite all the disappointment and the failings. But that's so difficult to do. We both know how much people can hold on to the stories, which bar one from being able to encounter that sacred place when it arises and arrives.
You're bringing up the seminal point to me. It's so, so smart what you're saying. And I'd be curious to hear from you in your ability to let go of whatever there was between you and your father, because we're human beings and no relationship is perfect, right? the gift you got from being able to let go of those things in that moment when he was dying, so that your life past that moment no longer has to be bound by those things.
Yes, but I worked long and hard. My father and I, ironically, because he wasn't very spiritually oriented, and yet he and I were in therapy when he was in his last years. We would go to therapy from time to time together to talk. We would work out things all along the way, because I was always kind of the shit disturber in the family, and particularly as an adult and not having children myself, I would loop back around, and I was living in different places, and I'd come and I'd stay with them. And it's also just my personality and my own personal commitment to work through the trenches. And that's just the way I've always been. So I was willing to get in those trenches with my parents as well. So I worked it. I worked it till the end, so that, as you say, I had a freedom to go on. And I have to say, I started dreaming about my father, and it took 6 months before I started dreaming about my mother, because she had had Parkinson's dementia. And that's an interesting topic in itself. It took about 6 months, I think, for her spirit or her essence to kind of cohere again before she could arrive or be in one kind of cohesive collection of selfhood, at least in a way that my psyche soul could recognize her. But my father, I started dreaming about him almost immediately. And he was always, as my mother then came to be, and still is when I dream about them, in their prime, almost in this essential soul quality place. And I want to add, with the work that I do with family constellation work and personal geometry, when I ask people to bring in an element, to have something represent their parents, the geometry of that relationship, the dynamic, is often quite difficult and usually goes to this distilled version of where the conflict still lies. Literally, the geometry of that conflict, whether there's too much distance, too little distance, the angle of it, whether one is seen or not seen, feel rejected or abandoned, or all these different things. But if you then ask somebody to bring in the soul of that person, of their parent, the one with whom they felt conflict or are in that narrative with, it can really shift and open the way for people to have more of a meta perspective, mm-hmm. that ultimately we are all souls, in my view, taking on these different roles and these different configurations in order to evolve, in order to grow and experience. And I have such appreciation about that for the bit of death that I've experienced right there in those last breaths. That sense, as you say, of the mystery of it, of that kind of both intensely intimate, but also meta perspective of whatever this is that we come to this planet to do in relationship, buying into these weird stories that we grapple with nose to nose, you know, and believe in and invest in and struggle with and grow from, and all the mess of being humans on this planet. And yet there's also this exquisite openness, you know, the great open, the great expanse that allows us to also somehow meet in that place of soul. And death is such a reminder of that.
Well, death is when all of that comes to the forefront.
Yeah.
So beautifully said. I think that's why I felt so connected to you right from the get-go, because you're mining the same territory.
Yes.
For different reasons.
Yes.
But the essence of existence is here for us to learn from, not just to be in, but to understand to some extent what we can. And what we can't to hold space for and realize that that's a big continuum we're part of. I find such relief in that personally, you know, that the sum of our parts, these stories that we hold, these memories that may or may not be true even. I mean, what is the sum total of a human existence?
It's greater than the sum.
It is. It's synergistic and it's energetic.
Yeah.
And it's all here within the flow of this organism. All of the questions and all of the answers, some of which we can't touch while we're alive. Maybe we can once we do shed this mortal coil. Maybe there's more we understand and know. Maybe there's not. Maybe there's nothing. What does it matter, actually? What matters is what we experience, what we need, what we feel, how we share that while we're here, because we are all one thing while we're alive here on this planet. We're one thing. And that, to me, is the essence of backing up from your own individual ego. I think gives an enormous amount of wide berth for people to start to approach their death in a way that all of these other things like, oh, my business will fall apart, or all of these real world things that we think are the most important things, they start to fall away very quickly.
I don't know if you've read Rabbi Lieder's book. It's a beautiful book, The Beauty of What Remains. And I haven't read all of it, but I distinctly remember his writing about that people's last words are often not revelatory in the way that Hollywood leads us to think. And I was kind of disappointed by that. I was thinking, oh, well, we'd like to think that in those last minutes or hours, people do suddenly recognize, you know, the truth of their existence and want to reconcile and express love that they hadn't been able to prior. What is your view of that?
It really depends on the individual and the trajectory of their dying. I think we're never not these simple creatures while we're still in this body. You know, there's something incredibly simple about us as well, because we are basic, we are base, we are mortal, we are meat, we're incarnate, right? We're incarnate. There's part of us, I believe, there's a part of us that is divine, and that's the part that's connected to everything else. But we're also this body. And this body is both profound and also simplistic. You know, it's not a duality. It's a non-duality. We're living both simultaneously until the minute we're not here. And I do find that people's last words often are irritated. They might be irritated because I don't think getting out of the body is so simple.
Yeah.
And I had a very interesting experience with a man that I accompanied for 9 months, and he was an engineer and super smart, very flawed individual in his own life. But he had been part of the team that built the F1 rocket that took Apollo to the moon. And one of the last conversations, coherent conversations I had with him, he said to me very matter-of-factly, I don't know how to get out.
Yeah.
And I do find that to be, whether somebody voices it or not, I feel that's a lot of the work that's going on for people. And I think it can be confounding and scary and confusing to understand, because at that moment, you're at the cusp of transmutation. And do you know? You may have been visited by those from the other side. There's all those stories of people with near-death experiences and what they experience, and then it's not their time and they come back. But when it is your time, what is the push-pull that's going on? What door is opening or closing in your consciousness or within your body or however it is that you're experiencing it? I didn't know Allen Ginsberg, but I did hear that at the very end of his life, even though he had done so much work on himself to prepare himself for his death, that he was very scared at the end. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that's unusual, mm-hmm. because we're not coming back to this incarnation. We're going to leave this behind, however we do. Whatever happens after that, and who knows, But there is that knowledge, that knowingness in the body and in the consciousness, perhaps too, that I'm letting go of this form that I have inhabited for this lifetime. It's what we know of ourselves. Yeah. There's also the experience of terminal lucidity, which happens very often and surprises me too when it happens, because it's like someone is really on the decline. They can't even hear anymore. And then suddenly they're awake and eating and they can hear. And it's, wait, what's happening here? It's like a last hurrah. It's a very interesting phenomenon. And people talk about it a lot because it happens a lot.
Happens with dogs. I call it a puppy surge. It definitely happens with dogs.
And it happens with humans too. And it's very fascinating. It's very fascinating because there's also the conversation of how do the senses leave the body? And this is a big part of what I try to concentrate on when I'm accompanying someone, is to try to tune into what senses are very much working and not working for them, and where they may be flowing more freely than in other ways. And that's a very ephemeral sort of thing to be able to bear witness to and try to glean information from. It's not like you can know for sure intellectually. People talk a lot about what's the last sense to go. And people wiser than me who have been accompanying the dying for much longer than me, a lot of them believe it's the sense of hearing. And there's clinical studies even that have been done that some concur that maybe we even hear past clinical death. So I do try to give that to people a little bit that are by the bedside, because what you talk about matters.
I was going to say, even in anesthesia, that makes sense, that somehow hearing may be connected to the brain or to the sense of self in a different way, because it's known that people can hear even when they're under anesthesia.
Well, I mean, we haven't gotten to talk about the senses at all, but for me, that's my beginning point into this work, is to be aware of all the sensorial elements that are happening, which is why I think most people want to die at home and most people don't. And that's a huge thing, because nobody wants to be in the emergency room with the bells and whistles and the fluorescent lights. And these things matter. They matter a lot. And when we panic, you're with somebody and like, oh, they're having a stroke, I have to call the emergency paramedics to come to take the person to the hospital. If they're already dying, these are the kinds of choices that have to be discussed. Mm-hmm. Because how a person wants to die, what their vigil plan might be if they've had the time and the presence of mind and heart to make that plan, you want to be able to execute that. And that also is, I think, an incredible gift for the people who are left behind. Because so much of what we carry through our lives are the bad deaths. What we didn't do right, we might feel. The regret we have about, you know, with my ex-mother-in-law, who all she wanted was that fried egg. And I was young and I was like, no, but the doctor said you can't have that. I got to mix your food. You can have like the soupy stuff. I'll put the egg in there. No, I don't want that. I walk out of the room. The caregiver comes. She tells the caregiver, I want the egg. The caregiver makes the egg. She rolls over and dies with a smile on her face.
Oh my God.
It wasn't my right to say how she should die. It was her right to say how she should die.
Wow.
But I mean, we do. We start dealing with dying people as if they're children. And they're not. They're dying people who have autonomy and have a right to their own dignity and to how they would want it to be for them. I can't say how that can be for anybody else, but I can certainly work on how I want it to be for me.
Yeah. Do you know how you want it to be for you?
Somewhat, I do. I think when I first trained as a doula, brilliant mentor, his name is Henry Fersko Weiss, and he's really sort of the godfather of the death doula movement in the United States, because he was a social worker and he had a friend who was a birth doula, and he trained in her training, and he thought, why aren't we doing this for dying? I don't understand. It's exactly the same. We need this. And so he codified his approach and he started to train people in 2003, I believe, is when he began. And in his training, which is really, you know, you can go for like a weekend workshop just to begin. And in the training, you break off into teams and then you spend that time answering these questions about where do you want to be? Who do you want to be there? How do you want it to be? Do you have particular lighting, smells, all these sensory elements of what would you want? And that was like, boom, you know, it was like an explosion in my brain. And I wrote what I wanted. And then strangely enough, I found this house that I'm living in now that has the small house that will be the home for the dying. And it was that little house I was in. That's where I saw myself, because there's a big deck and a wood stove. And I saw myself being pushed out onto the deck into the snow with the fire burning. For some reason, I like the idea of being cold when I'm dying. I don't know why, but I love the snow. And I'm a winter baby. I was born in December. So I saw my death being in the winter, and that I wanted to know that the warmth of the fire was there, but I was very happy to feel the snow on me. And then I found this land and this home, and it was very moving to me to know that I picked someplace that I wasn't in yet.
It's very beautiful too, Karen, that you want to share that sacred place and vision with others, you know, even if they may not want to die in the snow, but
well, they don't have to.
Exactly. I just have a few more quick questions. I think it's so important to talk about Alzheimer's and what your view of that is, because a lot of baby boomers will be getting Alzheimer's, whether that's environmental factors or just longevity or, you know, all of the things. I have my own view of it, but I'm really curious about yours and how that may or may not help or hinder the death process if one has it.
Yeah, it's a very complicated conversation, and I'm personally in it myself. My mother's twin, my mother died at 55, but her twin is still alive and she has Alzheimer's, and she's been deteriorating for more than 5 years now. She's 92. It's so confounding because there's no fixed reality. There are days where she has no clue as to who I am, or she'll think that her sister's still alive. She's waiting for her sister to come. And so then I'm always projecting, oh, well, then she's ready to go. When no, she's still here. And then she'll go back around into like weeks of sleeping and not really communicating. And then it's very confounding. I think this brings up probably what is tangential to the death conversation, but is equally as important, which is the caregiving crisis.
Oh, yeah.
Who's going to take care of all of us while we're dealing with living too long, probably? Forgive me for saying that, but I do believe that we are living too long.
I think
what the medical profession has done, because it's profit-driven. I just went through this with my dad in the ER. First, do no harm is supposed to be the tenet, but I think now we're in a position in the medical field where everything is about money. And even if you're a wonderful healthcare provider, which many doctors and nurses are, the construct that they're working within doesn't allow them to keep the job unless they adhere to this for-profit mentality, which is undermining all of the humanity in caregiving. Caregivers are not paid enough. There's not enough trained caregivers. People who are suffering from Alzheimer's, they're very difficult for any of us to understand exactly how we can care for them, given how it morphs and changes the face of how it presents itself.
Particularly depending on if somebody is able-bodied or not with Alzheimer's or dementia. In my mother's case, she wasn't able-bodied, but the people who are and can get up and go burn down the house, that's a whole other challenge.
Right.
Yeah.
What we are doing, the movement we're part of, the Homes for the Dying, which are non-medicalized, they can fill this void as well, which is respite care. So if somebody is at home and they have one caregiver, that person's on burnout for sure at a certain point in time. So if the person is non-ambulatory, then maybe they can be moved to another place that's equally as homey of an environment, or other caregivers that are volunteers for the home can go to help with respite care for the main caregiver for that person. But these are the kinds of conversations that are really starting to come up in the death care community, because we're seeing these gaps that are going to become bigger and more prominent as we all meet our end. Because the medical profession use the language of fighting and the battle, and that's how they keep us on this treadmill. Very few people will choose out of, by any means necessary, keep me alive, because the doctors and the medical profession will make us feel that that's what we need to do, is fight. And with Alzheimer's, what I just experienced with my dad in the ER was, if there was not someone there who he knew and felt safe with, he probably would have had a stroke and died there, because they were keeping him there because his heart enzymes were elevated, because he was a nervous wreck. He's laying on a gurney. He's complaining about his shoulder hurting him. He's riddled with arthritis, but they're putting him in an MRI tube to take a scan of his shoulder because he's complaining about it. So they're racking up these charges for Medicare, which is not about making it better for him right now. What was making it better for him was when I took him out of the ER and brought him home. So he has dementia, not Alzheimer's, but they were ignoring the dementia entirely. As we know, nobody's being looked at as a whole being when you're in the medical profession. You're going to be looked at for the specific thing. But it seems to me the dementia and the Alzheimer's quotient is being very much ignored when people end up being brought to the hospital, mostly in the emergency room. If there isn't a loved one there to be with them, it's a nightmare. It's an absolute nightmare. They inevitably restrained him when I wasn't there. And when I got back there, he was like a scared 10-year-old child. This is a horrible thing to do to a person who's 93 years old and doesn't really understand what's happening. So I think that this conversation about dementia and Alzheimer's is going to escalate in a very big way and a very bad way, because it's a huge gap right now. And I think that's why it's becoming part of the death care community conversation, because we're seeing that, how people are getting to us. It's a very long trajectory a lot of the time. It could be not even Alzheimer's and dementia. It could be a person living alone but needs a caregiver. And where's that caregiver going to come from, and who's that caregiver going to be paid by?
Yeah, though, of course, that's very different if you're not even self-aware enough to know you're still living, you're still existing. It's a conversation I just had with a friend of mine a couple of days ago, actually, which, again, loops us back around to, can we say, if I become demented now, like, can we right now, if I become demented in 10 years, take me out? And if so, how does that happen? Because there's a lot of people who don't want to just keep living for the sake of living, and it can really drain whatever money is left to leave behind. It's just ridiculous, the expense of keeping people alive who don't even know they're there.
And also the pressure of being the person who might have to make the decision for the one. That's also a torment that lives past that person's death, potentially, you know? So yeah, these are huge questions. And just to circle back to the good death, this is what I think about a good death, exactly what you're bringing up. Let's become conscious. Let's become aware and stop pushing away the reality that we are mortal, so that we can live our lives the way we want to. And when our time comes, we will have had a say in what we want individually for our own death, because it's our right to do so. And that's how we can have a good death.
Amen. Last two questions I ask everyone. What is your definition of embodiment?
You know, it's a feeling to me. It's not a thought, and it's heart. It's my heart. When my heart is filled and I feel that blood and life force pumping through me, then I know I'm embodied. I know I'm present within this body.
And lastly, what do you like best about being a living body, your living body?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think now it is every moment that I'm conscious that I am alive, to remind myself to just be present in that moment and to know what that feeling is to be alive, so that when I'm letting go of it, I will have lived the way I wanted to. No regrets. That's really what I'm aiming for. And I don't mean regrets about what I did or didn't do. I mean regrets about having lived the way I wanted to live while I was in this body.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. You're the best. I love what you're doing, and I'm so honored to be here and be part of it. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for sticking around till the end. If you enjoyed this episode, please give that like button a little click. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and hit that notification bell. I've got a bunch of fascinating guests lined up with trailblazing experts in the field that I'm really excited to share with you. I'm eager to hear from you too, so don't be shy. Drop a comment below. Share your thoughts, suggestions, or just say hi. Your insights on this episode mean the world to me. So go ahead, spread some love, like, subscribe, hit the bell, and share your thoughts below. Your support keeps this channel going strong, and I'm genuinely grateful for each and every one of you. Till next time, stay brilliant. I hope you found this episode inspiring. If you'd like to learn more about the many ways I'm encouraging and guiding the wider world to reclaim the brilliance of the body, please visit my website at www.alimezey.com. Thanks so much for listening. Until the next episode and beyond, reclaim your brilliant body. The Brilliant Body Podcast was created by Ali Mazay. This episode was co-produced and edited by Ali Mazay and Florence Popoff. Thanks to Florence Popoff also for my social media management, and to composer Blair, Mr. One Man Ben Wilson, for my theme music.